Congress.
United States, the White House and top congressional Democrats remained at odds Sunday over the scope of more assistance for 30 million American workers left unemployed by the coronavirus pandemic. In back-to-back appearances on ABC's This Week News show, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, the leader of the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives, and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin sparred over how much new aid the national government should approve beyond less generous state unemployment benefits. For 4 months of $600 a week extra national benefits expired Friday, but Pelosi and other Democrats want to extend the payments through the end of 2020, while U.S. President Donald Trump and his administration initially want to cut the extra aid to $200 a week while working towards a package that would set the aid at 70% of what a worker had been paid before being laid off as the virus swept through the U.S. Elsewhere in the world, Australia imposed an overnight curfew on its second biggest city, Melbourne, Sunday, and banned people from moving more than 5 kilometers from home in a bid to control a growing coronavirus outbreak that is infecting hundreds daily. Coronavirus infections in the Philippines surged past 100,000 Sunday, with medical groups declaring that the country was waging a losing battle against the virus and asking the president to reimpose a lockdown in the capital. Philippines has the second most cases in Southeast Asia after Indonesia and has had more infections than China, where the pandemic began late last year. And confirmed cases are hovering at near record levels in Japan, raising worries the pandemic may be growing more difficult to control. Japan has avoided a total lockdown, encouraging business activity while urging responsible behavior. This is VOA News. Who gets to be first in line for a COVID-19 vaccine? U.S. health authorities hope by late next month to have some draft guidance on how to ration initial doses. In the U.S., the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, a group established by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, is supposed to recommend who to vaccinate and when, advice that the government almost always follows. But a COVID-19 vaccine decision is so tricky that this time around, ethicists and vaccine experts from the National Academy of Medicine are being asked to weigh in, too. That group was chartered by Congress to advise the government how to decide. The CDC's opening suggestions are first vaccinate 12 million of the most critical health, national security, and other essential workers. Next would be 110 million people at high risk from the coronavirus, those over 65 who live in long-term care facilities, or those of any age who are in poor health or who are also deemed essential workers. The general population would come later. Experts say, though, that even if a vaccine is declared safe and effective by year's end, there won't be enough for everyone who wants one right away, especially as most potential vaccines require two doses. Well, the Mexican Army and state security forces have captured Jose Antonio Yepes, a prominent drug gang leader blamed for helping to fuel a major surge in violence in the country in recent years, authorities said on Sunday. Widely known as El Maro or the Mallet, Yepes was captured in an operation carried out early on Sunday morning, according to the federal government and authorities in the central state of Guanajuato, a principal flashpoint of gang violence. Yepes, boss of the Santa Rosa de Lima cartel, which is a Guanajuato-based gang, has been engaged in a bloody struggle for criminal control of the state with the Jalisco New Generation cartel, one of the country's most powerful and violent outfits. The Guanajuato Attorney General's office said security forces captured Yepes with five other people and rescued a kidnapped local businesswoman during the operation. And Finland's Prime Minister Sanna Marin has announced that she has married her longtime partner 8 months after becoming the head of government. The 34-year-old Marin said on her Instagram account that she married Markus Rikkonen on Saturday. They've been together for 16 years and have a young daughter. Marin is a keen advocate for environmental issues. When she became prime minister, she was the world's youngest serving head of government, a distinction she lost a few weeks later with the return to power of Austrian Chancellor Sebastian Kurz, who turns 34 later this month. This is VOA News Via Remote. I'm Laurel Lemon in Washington.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
Just talk about the present situation of Mali, and that's why we're looking for change. Because the president is no longer able to lead, but decisions are being made by a shadow government. As you can see, chaos already is here, instability is already here, so the president has totally failed.
The Malian opposition coalition plans to resume civil disobedience protests beginning Monday.
We want a level playing field. We want to set system in the electoral context this year, and we don't want the security forces to be on their side. And if that happens, we will make history this year. We will remove system from office.
The Tanzanian main opposition party, Chadema, plans to hold a two-day nomination convention beginning Monday.
It's very difficult to tell whether they standalone political parties or they are under the influence of the authorities in Kampala, in which case they could qualify to be fused with Mr. Museveni's NRM. And Museveni has not been shy about this.
And the Lord Mayor of Kampala officially joins the ranks of the Ugandan main opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Semaki, a leading member of the Malian opposition coalition M5-RFP, says protesters will resume civil disobedience beginning Monday. This after representatives of the coalition rejected recent recommendations from regional leaders from the Economic Community of West African State, ECOWAS. The opposition coalition says it plans to resume demonstrations to pressure President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita to step down. Samake tells me the demands for the president to step down is now non-negotiable, adding that the protests will continue until the country's leader relinquishes power.
The movement of June 5th, the M5-RFP, have instructed all of the followers to start the civil disobedience this Monday following the refusal and also the rejection of the recommendation from ECOWAS members.
So what are the main reasons why the recommendations were rejected? Because these regional leaders want to resolve the stalemate in Mali, to return to normal.
Well, that is the wish, and that's what we all want, normalcy in Mali. But the recommendations they made were unilateral, and they were not based on any dialogue with the movement. And the recommendations are not applicable in Mali, and they're contrary to the law and very paradoxical to the position of ECOWAS and the statutes of ECOWAS.
Now that you have rejected this and you are beginning on Monday regarding civil disobedience that you want to embark on, how will this achieve your objective?
Well, right now, our objective is to go out and request the resignation of President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, because we know that he does not have the goodwill and the good faith in resolving the political crisis, same way he was incapable of resolving previous crisis in Mali, and that put Mali in this very steep slope.
But Mr. Samake, he remains the president. He was legitimately elected. The constitution is on his side. And so far, your demands for his resignation hasn't affected him to step down. So why do the same thing if the objective or the result happens to be the same, that the man remains in office?
No, we have waited to be able to discuss and dialogue with regional partners and the international community to see if the president will recover his good sense and listen to the people of Mali. The movement will resume, and at this time, we're going to cripple the power until the president steps down. And this is our constitutional right. And this movement is a movement of all walk of life and diversity of Mali. It is not a a religious movement. It is not an ethnic group. It is the people of Mali in its diversity requesting change in governance, a better use of our resources, and also a better governance so that we live in better Mali. That is the reason why what our request is very legitimate.
Now, but here's a market. Some are concerned that you will undermine the constitution for which gives the mandate to a leader that you elected to protect the country's territorial integrity and to maintain peace, law, and order.
They should have been concerned a little bit earlier. This president has been the first several times on many accounts to violate the constitution, to violate the law, which brought us to a standstill where the country is not governable. He has not achieved any result. So that's where we are. The prime minister, we have never seen such a governmental instability in any country before, where we had seven prime ministers within 7 years. So the violation of the constitution started way far back. So it is not now that people who are concerned with respect of constitution, they should have done that earlier. They should have advised the president to take the right move to resolve the problems of this country. The constitution is not above the people. The purpose of the constitution is to allow people to live together in harmony. And today, everybody knows that we are no longer in harmony in this country, and the well-being of people of Mali compromised by corruption, by ill governance, and lack of leadership.
But don't you think that concerns being expressed by some Malians that if you get your way, the country could be plunged into crisis and chaos and instability and worsening the plight of the poor?
Today, Mali is in poverty. Mali is in instability. There is a chaos in this country. The country is ungoverned. Everything you just talk about are the present situation of Mali, and that's why we're looking for change. Because the president is no longer able to lead, but decisions are being made by a shadow government. As you can see, the chaos already is here, instability is already here, so the president has totally failed.
Yeyse Make is a leading member of the Malian opposition coalition M5RFP and a former opposition presidential candidate. He spoke with me from the capital, Bamako. The Tanzanian main opposition party, Chadema, plans to hold a two-day nomination convention beginning Monday. The party is expected to choose its presidential candidate during the event, which ends on Tuesday. Tundu Lissu, a former parliamentarian and a former leader of the Tanganyika Law Society, has declared his plans to seek the nomination of the opposition party, Chadema. Supporters of the opposition figure expressed concern that his plans to challenge the incumbent president could be derailed due to criminal charges against him. Lissu was in court days after his return from Belgium, where he received medical treatment for an assassination attempt 3 years ago. Criminal charges he faces include calling President Magufuli a dictator. Lissu tells me that he remains undeterred in his commitment to represent Chadema and to wrestle power from incumbent President John Magufuli and his CCN party.
The court cases that I faced in courts in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, are as baseless as they were 3 years ago when they were fired. I am charged with sedition and related offenses for making statements critical of the government of President Magufuli on various occasions. In the period between 2016 and 2017, when I was shot, I was arrested 8 times and charged in court 6 times for making statements criticizing the conduct of the president. Even under Tanzania's draconian laws, criticism, opposing the government and criticizing its conduct or its program is not a criminal offense. So what they have been trying to do is to criminalize dissent, to criminalize free speech, and these charges are just part of that, of criminalization of dissent and of free speech, but the charges are completely spurious.
Some of your supporters are expressing concern that perhaps these charges against you could limit your quest or prevent you from seeking the nomination of your party, Chadema, to become the presidential candidate to challenge President Magufuli in the upcoming October elections.
The charges as they are, they have no relation whatsoever with my qualifications to stand for election during this year's general election. Even if I were to be convicted, which I find unlikely given the nature of the charges, but even if I were to be convicted, they way that will disqualify me from standing for presidency during this year's general election. Now, that said, that does not mean that we should keep silent and the world should keep silent about these spurious charges. As I say, these charges are an attack on freedom of speech, which is guaranteed by the Constitution of Tanzania. Therefore, they are intended to frustrate the exercise of my free speech rights. They are intended to frustrate democracy in Tanzania, and they should be denounced as such.
What plans have you made in terms of going to the Electoral Commission to seek nomination for your party to become the presidential candidate of your party in the elections?
In terms of the electoral timetable that was released by the National Electoral Commission a few weeks ago, the commission will start giving out nomination forms to parties' nominees from August 5th, that is next Wednesday. And therefore, at this moment, my party's nomination convention starts on Monday and concludes on Tuesday. And if nominated, I shall be traveling to Dodoma to collect nomination forms from the National Electoral Commission. So as we speak, I'm not the party's nominee yet. That we'll know on Tuesday.
But Mr. Lissu, your party, Chadema, is in advanced talks with another opposition party, ACT Wazalendo, led by Zitto Kabwe, your colleague, former member of parliament colleagues. He also seeks to become a presidential candidate for a united alliance. How would you resolve your differences? Because if your party form an alliance, one of you would have to step down for the other to challenge President Magufuli.
As far as I know, and I think I know better in this regard, Honorable Zitto Kabwe is not standing for nomination by his party for the presidency of the United Republic of Tanzania. I understand that ACT Wazalendo tends to nominate the former foreign minister of Tanzania, Mr. Bernard Membe, as a presidential candidate. If that happens, we'll continue talking. I think we'll resolve the issues amicably. And whatever happens, we in Chadema will be fielding a presidential candidate.
What assurances are you giving the people of Tanzania in terms of what to look up for? Because supporters of Chama Cha Mapinduzi or the ruling party say, you know, all the noise you are making, supposedly, their words, not mine, it's just a publicity stunt, because CCN has dominated the political landscape in Tanzania since independence from Nyerere up to John Magufuli's time, and that he is going to win overwhelmingly coming October. What do you say to that?
If CCM was not worried about our chances in the forthcoming elections, it would have not cracked down on the opposition for the past 5 years. The fact of the matter is, CCM's continued hold on power today is only thanks to one thing: violence by the instrument of the state, by the police and the security forces. CCM is in power only thanks to the use of the security force, to the use of police. They prohibit lawful political meetings. They prohibit lawful political activity by political parties of the opposition, precisely because they are worried they have no support whatsoever amongst the Tanzanian population. They depend almost entirely on violence and by the instruments of the security force. We want a level playing field. We want to face CCM in the electoral contest this year, and we don't want the security forces to be on their side. And if that happens, we will make history this year. We will remove CCM from office.
Tundu Lissu is a former parliamentarian and a former leader of the Tanganyika Law Society. He spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. Erias Lukwago, the Lord Mayor of the Ugandan capital Kampala, has officially joined the main opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC. The FDC welcomed the move as a positive strategic step towards boosting the party's electoral prospect in next year's general election. Lukwago is a lawyer and a former opposition parliamentarian from the Democratic Party, or DP. It is, however, unclear what role Lukwago will play as a new member of the FDC. Supporters of the National Resistance Movement, the ruling party, say the move is unlikely to affect the ruling party. They remain confident the incumbent president and his party will defeat the opposition in next year's polls. Patrick Aboy Amuriat is the leader of the FDC. He tells me that the millions of supporters of the Lord Mayor will also join the opposition party, thereby rejuvenating his group in the run-up to the elections.
Yeah, I think that for some time now we worked with the Lord Mayor Elias Lukwago, but he hadn't joined the party. He comes from the Democratic Party, where he was a life member. And this is something that is, this membership is going to be kept for memory purposes. For us, I think he comes with a lot of value, a lot of skills, a lot of treasure, really, that would help the party move forward. He also comes with a huge amount of support, mainly in the central part of the country, particularly in the city of Kampala, which is a city that prides about having a day population of nearly 4 million people. And I think that he's always been winning convincingly and is quite popular within this part of the country. And therefore, we as the FDC celebrate his coming, and we think he comes with a lot of value with him, and it's going to certainly increase the momentum of our activities.
What role do you anticipate of him playing in your party, particularly when you have worked closely with him in the past?
Well, we think that Elias Lukwago is going to be one of our greatest mobilizers. Of course, we are now in the process of selection of a presidential flag bearer. We are yet to discuss the possibility of him joining that race. But really, he is going to be a game changer in the politics of the FDC. And we think that we will be getting dividend from his skills, his popularity, will turn many people who may have been on the fence for some time now to the party. He does not come alone. He comes with a number of leaders, especially around the Kampala district area that he is Lord Mayor. And I think that, you know, is really going to moral boost a party that has lately been branded by the media as lagging or slowing down. So we are going to regain traction and the confidence of the people by Elias Lukwago joining our party.
What do you say to supporters of the ruling National Resistance Movement Party who say that this is yet another opposition figure joining opposition party, and that NRM will continue to dominate and perform creditably well in the next election, and that President Museveni will win re-election in spite of what they described as what the opposition is doing as a publicity stunt?
I think I want to dismiss their claims with the contempt that they deserve. Really, anybody who knows what is happening in the politics of this country is would know that the NRM popularity is superficial. It's not real. The NRM popularity is as a result of serious manipulation during the election. They even do know that in the election of 2016, it is the FDC flag bearer who won the presidency. And so because of the power of the incumbency, where Mr. Museveni, the leader of the NRM, has got the ability to manipulate population and even change the results in his favor, I would like to say to them that, you know, they are merely sitting on a bubble, and this bubble will burst one day. So their so-called popularity is not real. It is something that is man-made through manipulation and the use of force.
Well, Patrick, there are plans by some people for an alliance. Some Ugandans are saying there are too many opposition political parties and you are divided, which enables President Yoweri Museveni to win elections. Some are saying that you should copy the recent example in Malawi, where the two opposition parties that had momentum joined forces to defeat the incumbent. What do you say to those who are urging you to form an alliance with a single presidential candidate to challenge President Museveni next year?
Today in this country, it's not very easy to determine who is truly in the opposition. Some of the political parties are actually working with Mr. Museveni. I can mention that some political parties have even got ministers serving in Museveni's government. And so it's very difficult to tell whether they are standalone political parties or they are under the influence of the authorities in Kampala, in which case they could qualify to be fused with Mr. Museveni's NRM. And Museveni has not been shy about this. Many times he has said, you know, without me, the Democratic Party would not be there.
Patrick Oboi Amuriat is the leader of the Ugandan Main Opposition Party, the Forum for Democratic Change, FDC. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Global Financial Integrity, a not-for-profit group, organized a webinar about combating natural resources crime in Africa. It featured a panel of experts from international organizations, including the Natural Resource Governance Institute and the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crimes. The experts discussed, among others, emerging trends and policy solutions to natural resource crime affecting oil, gemstones, minerals, and wildlife in Africa. Alexandra Gillies is an advisor at the Natural Resource Governance Institute. The organization, which works in many African countries, focuses on transparency and governance issues in the oil, gas, and mining sectors. She tells me that the institute has active programs in a number of African countries. She also says that the organization also works closely with civil society groups as part of a strategy to combat corruption in the oil, gas, and mining sectors in their respective countries.
I think it's an important time for those of us who care about fighting crime and fighting corruption to come together and share our observations about what the current risks are. I mean, the world is changing so quickly and the context is very different than it was, you know, just a few months ago. And so I think that kind of opportunity to come together and share observations is even more important now than ever. I was able to speak about how corruption risk in Africa's oil sector may have changed over the past few months as oil prices have fallen, and given the pandemic and the restrictions on movement that come with it. And then other participants shared their ideas around wildlife trafficking and illegal mining and other topics. So as a chance to kind of connect with other experts, I found it quite useful. And yet these are huge challenges that will take more than webinars to address, for sure.
So Alexandria, talk to me about some of your work on the continent. Which countries are you helping, or is your organization helping to address some of these difficulties in the fight against corruption in some of these natural resource rich nations?
Personally, I've done a lot of research on oil sector corruption. I just came out with a book called Crude Intentions that looks at how oil corruption works around the world. In that book, I spend a lot of time discussing Nigeria and Angola in particular, but also examine corruption cases from Chad, Equatorial Guinea, Congo Brazzaville, Libya, and other African countries. And what can we learn from past corruption cases that can help us fight corruption more effectively in the future? And from looking at corruption cases in Africa from the past 5 or 10 years, it's very clear that there are certain tactics that are used over and over again, and that there's certain parts of the oil sector that are particularly vulnerable to corruption, where we see problems cropping up over and over again. One example is national oil companies and how they spend their money, how they contract with other entities. Those spending and contracting systems become the site of corruption because they are places where a lot of political agendas tend to kind of infiltrate, and they're subject to far too little scrutiny and too little transparency.
Alexandra, a lot of Africans have said that although there is corruption in some parts of Africa with regards to natural resources, oil and gas inclusive, the partners of these alleged criminals are in the West. And sometimes when they engage in such malpractices or corruption, the proceeds are stored in foreign banks. How do you help to resolve some of these challenges?
This is a very important point. None of the cases I've looked at from Africa, and there are dozens, were purely African operations. There's no such thing as purely African corruption, and yet that's what we hear about way too often. These are international schemes with all kinds of foreign players playing different roles. Sometimes you have oil companies that are bribing public officials in order to access lucrative business opportunities. Sometimes oil companies are, you know, turning a blind eye to corruption. So they may not be directly involved, but they're nearby and they're not kind of raising the alarm when they could. Sometimes they partner with local companies that they know are too closely aligned to certain political elites. And that's just in the oil sector.
So looking forward, what impact do you think the webinar and the discussions you've had and future discussions would help in mitigating or in the fight to limit corruption in Africa, in areas where you currently work?
Right. So mitigating corruption will require action, not just discussion, by a whole range of actors. So African governments, governments outside the continent, private companies, even citizens to engage in oversight, and journalists and activist groups. So a lot of different actors will need to do more if we're going to reduce corruption. And so I do think there's value in raising awareness, not just of how the seriousness of the challenge, but what are the practical steps that can be done? What types of transparency, what types of regulation, what types of law enforcement activity are needed? Who needs to do what, basically? So I think whether it's a webinar or other methods of sharing information, it does help get the word out about the kinds of change that need to happen if we're going to avoid seeing damaging corruption scandals again in the future.
Alexandra Gillies is an advisor at the Natural Resource Governance Institute. She spoke with me from New York. This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. But first, the Football Association of Zambia is ending its domestic league this year earlier than it had originally been scheduled, according to Adrian Kashala, Secretary General of the Football Organization. He says the new season has been tentatively rescheduled for October 17. Officials of the football administration, he says, took the decision to limit the spread of the coronavirus. This followed reports that some of the players have tested positive to COVID-19. Kashala tells me that closing the league earlier than planned gives the Football Association time to boost safety protocols and to limit the spread of the disease in the upcoming season.
We have challenges related to securing the testing appointments and also the receipt of results from the health authorities. This is because our health institutions are overwhelmed with a rise in the cases of COVID-19 that has hit Zambia. From the clubs for non-compliance to COVID-19 health regressions, we, as FAS, in yesterday's executive committee meeting, resolved that the league be cut short as at week 27, and the winners declared, as well as those to be demoted, to be declared as of 7 August 2020. So we are not suspending the league, neither are we cancelling the league. We are just ending it as at week 27, at a time when every club has played an equal number of games.
Adrian, what do you say to those who are of the opinion that the Football Association of Zambia perhaps could have copied the measures implemented by some Western football countries, including the EPL and La Liga, or even the German Bundesliga, by playing and adhering to safety protocols? And because some of these leagues have returned, although without the fans, they said you could have done the same. How do you respond to that?
We may not have similar capacity with the Western teams. And in doing so, we still have a lot of challenges in as far as meeting the required standards is concerned.
So we want to make mention that we did put the guidelines, and of course we had been watching the European League running, the La Liga running, and we did look at what they were doing, and of course we picked something that could suit our situation here. But I think we are also saying the compliance levels in Zambia were very, very low, and this led to some of the players catching the virus. And so we have been trying to do that, but I think enforcement has not been there, and also in trying to observe those guidelines, our clubs have been reluctant.
Adrian, with the conclusion of this league ahead of the originally scheduled date, what will the time left to the start of the new season give the Football Association of Zambia to adequately prepare for the next season?
The Association of Zambia has tentatively put 17th October as the start of the 2020-2021 soccer season, depending on how the COVID situation will be by then, or have it reviewed and probably push it forward. But what is important for us as an association is that we know that football is life for our players, and also we know that life is also important to sustain. So in doing so, we are mindful of the fact that we do not want to lose any single life on account of us playing football on the pitch. We surely try by all means to put in mitigating factors that will make us start the new season.
When you resume in October, is there a possibility that fans could return to the stadiums to watch their favorite domestic players? Or will you follow protocols where in the Western world where fans are barred from the stadium?
I also understand that barring of the supporters from the stadium is on account of the prevailing situation. The COVID-19 pandemic has hit everybody, and in doing so, we are just trying to help the situation, or trying to mitigate the spread of the pandemic. And when we get back in October, hopefully, we also intend to assess the situation. We are not going to sleep as fast. We'll continue to monitor the situation. Depending on how the conditions and the situation will be as at October 17th, we should be able to be guided by the health authorities whether we can allow the fans into the stadiums, or we maintain playing our games behind closed doors.
Adrian Kashala is the Secretary General of the Football Association of Zambia. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. A heavy security presence in the Zimbabwean capital Friday shut down planned opposition protests against the government's handling of corruption and the economy. Opposition leaders went into hiding as they faced arrest and security forces cleared the streets. For VOA, Columbus Mavunga reports from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
On social media Friday, Zimbabwean police said the country was calm and peaceful and urged the public to continue with their normal day-to-day activities with the full knowledge that their safety and security is guaranteed. In Harare, however, there was a heavy presence of armed soldiers and police who ordered shops to close down early and sealed off all roads leading to the central business district. While a handful of demonstrators tried to gather, security forces made sure that protests planned by opposition groups never got off the ground. Makomborere Harzivishe was one of the organizers of the protests. Speaking to VOA by phone from an undisclosed location, he characterized the day as a victory for the opposition.
For us, the demonstration was very successful because, you know, usually we are all victims of ZANU-PF, we are all victims of corruption. But when you call for demonstrations against poverty, against expensive prices, usually it is, you know, the people of Zimbabwe getting in the streets. But today we made a strategic retreat, shut down and went home and left the police officers and the soldiers to have a demonstration on behalf in there in the streets. If you check the amount of resources that were used to deploy those merchants of terror by the panic in Mnangagwa regime. So as of now, we've delivered a score. There was a successful people-powered shutdown. So this is just but a beginning of a weeks-long, probably months-long revolution.
Haruzivishe is one of 14 political activists police said they want in connection with the protests, which were not sanctioned by authorities as required by law. Tafadzwa Mgwadi, the spokesman for the ruling ZANU-PF party, said Zimbabweans snubbed the protest calls because of the coronavirus epidemic.
It is quite very clear that Zimbabweans are now pretty aware of the realities of COVID-19, and this is why they have spanned and literally have refused to participate in the purported demonstrations that had been called irresponsibly by merchants of death and people that were branded as no any good wishes for the people of Zimbabwe. It had been made to be potentially Zimbabwe's doomsday.
ZANU-PF supporter Samson Malibo says he was against the protests because they affect his business of mending tires in Highfields, one of Harare's poorest suburbs. He says it's a dead day. People are not moving around because of the opposition planned protests. There's no business activity. People have been ordered to remain indoors to contain the protests. Such events, the protests, are useless and affects our livelihoods. We depend on informal businesses, he says. Meanwhile, the trial of three female Zimbabwe opposition leaders facing charges of faking their abduction began Friday. The three women disappeared for 2 days in May and said they were kidnapped and beaten by state security agents. Women's rights group Equality Now released a statement calling for the charges against the trio to be dropped. The three, Joanna Mamombe, Netsai Marowa, and Cecilia Chimbiri, faced 10 years in jail if convicted. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Zambia's Football Association has cancelled the domestic league following a spike in COVID-19 cases. The association's general secretary, Adrian Kashala, told the media the league would end on August 6th, by which time all teams would have played 27 rounds of matches. The Zambian Football League resumed 2 weeks ago after it was prematurely suspended in March over concerns about the coronavirus pandemic. Two sides, Forest Rangers and NAPSA Stars, have reported the highest number of COVID-19 cases, with 28 and 19 cases respectively. Zambian Football Association has decided that 2020-2021 season will now start on October 17th. Zambia has so far confirmed 5,555 cases with 41 deaths. Meanwhile, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, next presidential elections are scheduled to take place in March 2021, 4 years after the current president, Ahmed, stunningly dethroned long-standing ruler Issa Hayatou. But now the Malagasy says he's undecided about running for a second term in office next year. Ahmed, the subject of an ongoing FIFA ethics probe, says he's likely to decide later on and only after seeking guidance from colleagues, according to press reports. The former Madagascar FA head announced his 2017 candidacy 4 months before elections and just a week before the deadline. On a sad note, Cameroon legend Steven Tatto died on Friday in Yaounde after a short illness. He was 57 years old. Tatto, one of the greatest Cameroonian players of all time, was until his death a staff at the Cameroonian Football Federation. He was the captain of the famous class of 1990 that made global headlines at the 1990 FIFA World Cup in Italy before crashing out at the quarterfinals the farthest by any African team at the time. The right back also captained the Lions at the 1994 FIFA World Cup in the USA. During his career, Cameroon won the Africa Cup of Nations in 1998 in Morocco. In rugby, the Dubai and Cape Town rounds of the 2021 Rugby World Sevens, due to take place in November and December 2020, will not take place because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Men's and women's events had been scheduled for November 26th, 28th, and December 4th to 6th, 2020, respectively. World Rugby has set up a working group to evaluate the rest of the season. New Zealand were awarded men's and women's titles for 2020, having led the standings when the suspension came. Dubai has staged a sevens event every year since the inaugural tournament in 1970. In athletics, the World Athletics says it will expel the Russian Federation as a member if it does not pay an outstanding fine and costs before August 15th. A payment of just over $6 million for anti-doping breaches was due by July 1st. But Russian Sports Minister Oleg Matysyn is reported saying the payment will be made before mid-August. Russia's Athletics Federation was suspended in 2015 after a report commissioned by the World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA, found evidence of mass doping among track and field athletes. Any expulsion, however, would have to be approved by the World Athletics Congress. And that's it for this edition of Netland Africa Sport. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Just like the sun lights up the earth, it lights up my life. The only one I ever see with a smile so bright. And just yesterday, you came around my way. You changed my horse in way. With your astonishing beauty, oh, you could not make a brother sing. No ordinary thing, a supernatural being. And no, you are brighter than the moon, brighter than the star. I love you just the way you are. And you are my African queen, the girl of my dreams. You take me where I've never been, yeah. You make my heart go ding-a-ling-a-ling. Oh, you are my African queen, the girl of my dreams. And you remind me of a thing, and that is the African beauty. They are standing one. I look into your eyes, girl, what I see is paradise. Hey, you captivated my soul. Now every day I want you more. Now I cannot deny this feeling I'm feeling inside. Hey, no one I cannot take your place. You cannot take your space. And it's a fact I cannot erase. And no, you are the one that makes me smile. Make me float like a boat upon the night. Girl, you are my African queen, the girl of my dreams. You take me where I've never been. You make my heart go ding-a-ling-a-ling. Yeah, you are my African queen, the girl of my dreams. And you remind me of a thing, and that is the African beauty. Yes, I know, you are my African queen, and I know, see, I know, see, I know what I am feeling in my heart and in my soul. Oh, I know that it's this love, and I know that this love was surely sent from up above, cause you're the only one that I think of. You are my African.
African queen, and I know that it means that you're the only one that I will serve. I'll give you my heart, my love, my body and my money. Every other thing you think of. In a man, who could think of anything better than you? Who could think of ever hurting you? Sacrifice my all, I'll give it all to you. You are my African queen, for real. You are my African queen.
Your cargo, let's fly in your chopper. Hey, yeah. Oh, you know, I'm a quad of tiny, tiny now. Corner moving in my gumbang, I'm set to slow. One for love, baby, one for quick, cause I want one, yeah, but love, nigga. But send me a cuss low. Would you mind, calling your phone at any time? Would you mind?
Good to die, good to die. Oh, Danny, baby, oh, my team, I go with a good. Daktari wewe umeniponesha, sikio la kufa limepata dawa, moyo wangu aliwacha kidonda, kisha kila mara kunitonesha. Moyo wangu baby mimi ninakupa, wewe peke yako ndiye kipoza. Kama penzi bia basi nime overdose, waligula bia na mwendo wa makosa, nikifangalia tayari umepose. Endapo kilia mimi nitafuta chozi.
Was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the sun does not refuse to shine on a village just because it is small. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.